Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to another exciting and informative edition of Atlanta Business Radio. I'm your host today, Ryan McPherson, and as always, we're broadcasting from the beautiful Regis Executive Suites here in sensational Sandy Springs, Georgia. As a reminder, make sure you are connected with us on social media, Twitter, at Business Radio X, and you can also follow the program here today, Atlanta Biz Radio, Atlanta B-I-Z Radio on Twitter as well. And check us out on Facebook. Leave the thoughts and comments there. You can see photos of our in-studio guests and interact with us on the social media stratosphere. And now it's my distinct pleasure to welcome to the program here today two gentlemen who are not unfamiliar with the Business Radio X studios. First, let's say hello to Kit Hughes. He's CEO of a company called Look Listen. How are you doing this morning, Kit?
I'm hanging in there.
You're hanging? Long weekend?
Three kids.
Oh, man.
You know.
Yeah. But you made time out this Monday morning to come down and join us on Atlanta Business Radio, and we're very happy to have you. Please share just a little bit about Look Listen and how you're doing good work for folks.
Look Listen is a digital advertising agency that is part of a new generation of ad agencies. So the days have gone by of the Mad Men era ad agencies. And we are an agency that plays at the intersection of data, technology, and creativity.
That's an exciting intersection. Just don't play too long out there in that intersection, or you may get hurt.
We play in the street.
Yes, that's right. So we'll go deeper into that. But let's also introduce to the program here today another guy who's not unfamiliar with our studios, Michael Flock. He is founder, chairman, and CEO of Flock Specialty Finance. How are you, Michael?
Terrific, Ryan. Thank you for having me this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for joining us. First time on Atlanta Business Radio, but not your first time on the network, right?
Correct.
Good, good. Well, tell us a little bit about Flock Specialty Finance. What are you doing that's different than other people in that industry?
What we are doing that's different is providing capital to the underbanked, whether they're companies that buy bad debt, who can't get bank financing because of the nature of these assets, or even people in the subprime credit markets. We're now also providing capital to companies who provide loans to subprime consumers. We're also providing also capital to, I would call them, other niche segments like tax liens and litigation funding. So we're essentially a company that provides capital for companies that have difficulty getting traditional bank financing because the business that they're in is risky. The only way they can get bank financing is through personal guarantees. So we have a team of folks that has experience in these distressed asset classes, lots of good underwriting history and data. Plus, we've got folks who have operational experience in these markets as well. And so we have a team that provides a lot of value add. That's why we say we're more than just a transaction.
Right.
We provide value add with the capital so we can help these small middle market companies grow effectively.
Very interesting. I know this is an industry probably a lot of people don't know much about. And how did you find yourself coming to found Flock Specialty Finance? I know you spent some time in corporate America. Is that right?
Yeah. I founded this kind of by accident, but I'll try to keep this brief, but it's an interesting story. Yeah, no, I was one of those kids that wanted to be, first president of the United States.
Okay.
And I got into the White House when I was in college under Richard Nixon and met him my first day.
Is that
there.
Right?
Yeah, but I spent a couple of years then in the summers in politics in Washington, both at the White House and the Senate. I realized that's not my thing.
Right.
It was so much fun.
But as a young age, you were interested in politics.
I was very idealistic.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
And, the chance to meet the president the first day was awesome. Go to a press conference and swearing in for John Conley, Treasury Secretary.
Wow. Well,
it was cool. But then as I got older, I realized that, appearances and reality are very different. You can't make any money in politics, at least honestly. I got an internship in France, actually. I went over to Paris on a Fulbright. And one summer there, I worked at IBM.
Okay.
And so I decided my dad was in business. So I thought, okay, let's try international business. And the folks in IBM Paris said, as an American, you should come back to the States. So I came back to the States and joined IBM out of, graduate school.
And you felt comfortable doing that? You felt you were at the right place? It was providing you that professional?
IBM, this was now in the mid-70s.
Okay.
And IBM was on a roll. it was a great place to get started because they had awesome training, terrific brand. And so I was there for 8 or 9 years. And, you know, my dream then was to try to get to the top of the company. AT&T, though, got into the computer business. And a lot of my friends from IBM were leaving to go to AT&T to help them get started. So it was sort of like a startup within a big company. I got an offer to be the branch manager in New Orleans for the equipment division of AT&T. And then I jumped at it because it was the I was only 30 years old. Mm-hmm. The first time to get to become a branch manager at 30 at AT&T was pretty unusual, but it was the worst branch in the country. But I like things that are broken. You know, okay. IBM, I turned around the Gulf and Western account. It was the worst
account. So you were kind of coming in
I
there.
I like to take things that appear to not perform and to be doing poorly, because then it's easy to surpass expectations. And so, so I jumped to New Orleans when I was 30. Anyway, I spent several years there. I got promoted a few times, had a lot of fun. After I turned around that branch, I also was product manager or product marketing manager for the Merlin product. Also then got into M&A work later over in Europe for AT&T. So I got my first taste of mergers and acquisitions. In the middle of all that, though, I got an offer from Dun & Bradstreet to come and turn around their collection company. And, you know, I thought, ugh, collections, you know. Yeah, that's not why I went to college, you know, get into collections. It's sort of a grimy, you know, the perception is it's a grimy, dirty industry. But they said, Michael, we got an opportunity to turn around the third-party commercial collection company, which is the largest in the world, actually. It was a small piece of D&B, but it was large in its own market. And so I jumped at that opportunity. We turned it around through reinventing the company. Instead of just doing third-party collections, meaning charged-off debt collection, we got into the market of it's called early outs or first-party outsourcing, where you essentially become the collection department for your customer. So we, in other words, D&B employees were calling on, let's say we got the UPS account, we got Dell, we got Sprint, and we were essentially then calling in the name of Dell UPS on their customers. That was a giant market. We transformed the company, did really well, also got promoted to run all their international operations except Europe. Europe was the star. I got all the junk, you know, right. All the cats and dogs. Again, no one wanted to touch it.
You know,
Asia, you know, China. But Australia was pretty good, Canada. But then I also had Uruguay, Brazil.
Oh, yeah.
So I had to turn those around, and we had to come up with a new business model. Let's fast forward. My wife was getting sick of all this international travel. She's from Buckhead. We had two kids in New Jersey, and she's in a snowstorm in New Jersey, and I'm, you know, on some beach doing business in Australia. She didn't like the looks of this thing. So she said, honey, let's go back to Atlanta. So I went to Atlanta, got into doing my own business. Okay, so here's the catch. I didn't want to go into some middle executive role at a big company in Atlanta, because I was at the top of D&B, one of the top five guys. So I said, I'm not going backward, but, you know, I saw all my friends making money in M&A work. And so I launched my own kind of M&A consulting business. I did that for 4 or 5 years, but it was hard. It was very, very hard going from corporate to entrepreneur.
Okay.
But I was a big saver. I had saved a lot of money, but still, it was really tough.
So you liked that security of the corporate world a little bit.
I did. I didn't realize how much I liked it.
You know?
And in 2001, when I launched the M&A business, my M&A consulting business, I had a retainer from GTCR. Mm-hmm. GTCR is one of the largest PE funds in the country. Now it's like $8 or $9 billion. The founder of that is Bruce Rauner, who's now governor of Illinois. And Bruce gave me my first retainer, and we were doing well. And then all of a sudden, 9/11 hit. Boom.
9/11, 2001.
2001.
Yeah.
And about a month later, he called me and said, you know, Michael, we love you. We like this industry of credit and collections. He had already done a couple of deals there. And he said, I got to tell you, we can't keep your retainer up. Right. So, oh, no. Oh, no. The first day in my life.
Yeah.
No paycheck. None. Nada. But I continued to do M&A work with other PE funds, making some small consulting fees. I actually got a deal done in 2005 with a collection company. The PE fund, though, didn't agree on how to run the company. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make some major changes. They wouldn't let me. So I left, got into investment banking at a local firm here called Croft & Bender.
Okay.
I was advisor to them on all their deals in this space. Their network for capital was different than what we needed. So I started my own company in 07, meaning we were doing, as Flock Advisors, we were doing M&A work for credit and collection companies. In 08, we had 5 engagements, but September of 08, crash, boom.
Yeah.
You know, all the banks, everybody stopped everything. So that year, you know, I made maybe $50,000. Two kids in private school, you know, a nice house. Uh-oh.
You're right.
So, but I then, but all along the way, I realized that there were these debt buying companies. There were, you know, small middle market companies that had niche expertise in certain, you know, segments, but they couldn't get capital, particularly after the crash of 08. Mm-hmm. So I thought, what if I raised a fund to finance these debt buyers? Because they were making 20, 30, 40, 50% on their money, but they couldn't get capital now. So along with a friend, a peer at Dun & Bradstreet, who's the chief technologist there, Cliff Bateman, he and I started this thing together. And he brought in, put in a bunch of money, brought in some more friends. I brought in some bunch of friends. You know, we raised about close to $20 million. And we started funding debt buyers. We mm-hmm. had a great run. And in 2013, we got an offer from a small hedge fund out of New York. They bought us out. And we tripled our investors' money in 4 years.
That must have been exciting
for you. It was exciting.
Yes.
Although we were small. We only had about seven or
but
eight
you,
customers.
You got to a point where you could see some of the benefits.
Yes. Absolutely. And, right. But that was, interestingly enough, though, Ryan, that was a good time to start because the prices of the debt had plummeted after mm-hmm. the crash. So it was easy almost. I won't say easy, but these are all tough. You know, when you're buying charged off debt, you're paying pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. You pay one penny and try to collect three pennies. And that's how you get your 30, 40% return.
Yes.
It's much easier when prices are low and the supply was high, which is the case in 2008 and 9 and 10. Okay, fast forward, yeah. We get bought out in 13, and then we go institutional. Mm-hmm. And so we've raised capital now from a major a wealth management firm here in Atlanta called Signature FD. Mm-hmm. And our legacy investors jumped in, and then we brought in some senior debt from three or four different banks. So we're now very, very well capitalized. And again, our mission is to provide capital to companies that have these special niches of expertise in buying bad debt. And then also other companies that are now into the consumer revolving loan subprime. We're also into tax liens and litigation funding. Those are some of our
newer ventures. And where do you see the company growing in 2016 and beyond?
Well, we see us growing in these, I call them these other non-traditional asset classes. Here's another one, healthcare. Hospitals have been selling debt for a while, but it's been very slow. I think hospitals are going to continue to grow and into the market of selling debt because they need the cash. They mm-hmm. need the cash flow, although they're not typically known for their financial management skills. So hospitals, mm-hmm. You know, they're focused on providing medical support for patients, obviously. That's not their thing. But that problem is the opportunity for investors like us who will go in and coach hospitals on how to sell the debt. We've got, you know, a client that loves that. Mm-hmm. So we'll be growing in healthcare. Litigation funding, plaintiff cash advance. That's big. We've got a very good customer there, Cherokee Funding. Cherokee Funding, who has a long history in that and is doing very well. So litigation funding, personal injury claims. We're funding a group that buys personal injury claims. Tax liens, got a nice track record there. Companies that buy tax liens in different states. And then, of course, subprime credit. We've got a couple customers who are providing subprime credit. And so I see growth in those asset classes.
Yeah, so good things happening for Flock Specialty Finance and a lot of different avenues of growth for sure. What do you need more of? Do you need more talent over there? Do you need more help outreach to the community? I mean, what do you need more of to continue this growth?
To continue this growth, we need more. We will need more capital and more people.
Right.
And the capital we're going to need is probably a little more leverage, more bank financing to leverage our equity, but also capital that that is patient, that understands the risk in these different asset classes. Because we collateralize the capital we loan or provide to our customers with the portfolios themselves. We don't ask for a guarantee. And we're not an asset-backed lender. What we do is we provide a joint venture structure. We advance up to 90% for our customers. They put in 10, but it's all done off the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So the customer doesn't have to encumber their own balance sheet with that. So it's pretty flexible. So we're going to need more capital, and mm-hmm. we're going to need people with different types of expertise, because right now, not all our team, you know, is an expert at everything. So we're going to have to bring in folks that have had experience more in these subprime markets, how to do the scores.
More of those niche market experts that you can then begin to serve more effectively.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So that's good. So some more good things coming from Michael Flock and his team at Flock Specialty Finance for sure. If our listeners want to get more information about your services, how would they do so?
Check out our website at www.flockfinance.com or give me a call, 770-644-0851.
There you have it, folks. And we'll have those links up later on our website as well, atlantabusinessradio.com. But thank you so much, Michael, for joining us. Please stick with us as we now turn our attention over here back again to Kit Hughes from Look Listen CEO, another entrepreneur on the show today. What was that journey like for you? Did you always know you were an entrepreneur, or did it blossom later on in life like Michael here?
That's a fantastic question. And I feel like you have to shift some serious mental gears from, you know, from his trajectory to mine. Very, very different. So I didn't know what an entrepreneur was until I was really one. Mm-hmm. And I started in art school. I mean, when going back to a kid, I felt like a deep connection into making things. So art was a natural thing for me to pursue. Mm-hmm. And then going to school, I was fascinated with science and started school with a double major in pre-med and art.
Okay.
And the fascination with science and the complexities of the human body.
Yes.
And they're actually closer than you would think. And so, but I very quickly veered away from the pre-med track because I couldn't handle the clinical side. It was very hard to see people in pain, which would influence later sort of humanitarian interests of mine. Following through art school teaches you how to be a workaholic because the work is never good enough. You stand the work up in front of a peer group at which they take shots at it and you have to defend it, but you're always making things. You're always having to create new ideas. So really the original entrepreneurship programs in college is the art program. Mm-hmm. where you're giving creative individuals a lab environment.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way. You're actually learning to promote yourself.
Yep.
You're working hard on your own timeline, your own schedule. No one's telling you what to create.
Yeah.
It's all comes from within.
Yeah, and your worst habits surface.
Yeah, they're exposed for sure
in that period. Yep. So I dropped out of college, 99 or 2000, and started my first company. It failed within the first year. I had moved to Atlanta and did not realize the true network effect that I had. I was in Nashville originally, and didn't realize the network effect for a services business. And so I knew that I'd want to take a stab at it again one day. Knew that I needed to take a little bit of time to figure things out. So I went back to school. I went to University of Georgia, did some research fellowships, continued to work while completing my degree, finally found a path back into entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. took a brief stint in corporate. I worked for a big Dutch company in their design organization, but knew that it was only a period of time that I would sort of work inside of a big global company. Got to have the wonderful experiences of traveling around the world and meeting people and getting to learn different business cultures, it's mind-blowing how if you're given that opportunity and if you soak it up like a sponge, how it can truly affect the rest of your life and your worldview on business. Mm-hmm. And getting to understand Dutch business culture very, very well, but then at the same time, Asian business culture, and then part of running design for a global portfolio, getting to see how retailers in different markets worked, and this was really exciting. Look Listen was essentially round two of the company that I had started dropping out of college the first time, and I went to one of my best friends growing up. And we had played in punk bands as teenagers and in college. And I said, you know, I think December of 2007 is the right time to start a business on the eve of the financial
yes.
crisis. He agreed, took a little bit of convincing, more than he would admit, but he was on board, and we figured it out, went through the several years of me working a full-time job and him living in poverty, dedicated to the day-to-day of doing some of the business. Once I focused and left the corporate job, that's when we started our hyper growth. I knew that it was perfect for me and for my life, my lifestyle, my worldview.
Yeah, and here we are today, 2016, Atlanta Business Radio. The company's growing.
Yeah.
You're serving the market like no others are doing. And so, yeah, tell us, what makes you different? What are you bringing to the market that the other companies are not?
I've been asked that question so much over the past, let's call it 12 months or so, because of hitting the Inc. 500. There's so much focus on what did you guys do? It's always asked from a position of, have you done something drastically unique from mm-hmm. other companies? Mm-hmm. Our success has been tied to what I think makes typical entrepreneurial ventures successful, which is you have to be very, very resourceful. You have to possess an element of grit that no matter what happens, you're picking yourself, dusting yourself off, and you're going to go back in slugging. And so we certainly had that, but we had to figure out our own corner, if you will, of the agency world. We were just a digital studio for several years. We were designing and building websites, and we did stuff that was super high profile. In our first couple of projects, we did, NYU hired us to do a video. It was a great budget. It helped launch us and get us off the ground. We were going up against MTV veterans against in the pitch, and we created a really great pitch. We also, in those early days, we learned as business partners. So Paul, my business partner, we essentially took the dynamic that we had in a band. I was the front man, mm-hmm. and I had these ideas for songs and for the theme of the band. And he was this guy, immensely talented in music and could write all the parts, play a lot of the instruments. And so we would walk into a meeting playing those parts. I was slightly more manicured.
Okay.
And it'd be like, all right, Paul, roll your sleeves up and show your tattoos. You'll come off as the creative archetype. I'll come off as the business archetype. After we leave the meeting, we both know we're doing all the work
yes.
together, but to be able to sort of play to the Pavlovian sort of things. And then as we matured as a business and started to get more clients and find ourselves in pitches where we were going toe to toe with other established agencies, or we were pitching clients that were private equity backed, we realized we did truly need to create a differentiator. Over the past few years, we've understood that because of why clients have hired us, which is not just to deliver killer creative, mm-hmm. but to also have a strong understanding of the advanced analytics behind it. So we don't sacrifice the creative work to be able to deliver highly measurable, data-driven outcomes. And so that's why I say we kind of play at this intersection of the creativity and data and the technology side of things, which is part of this new generation of agencies, because mm-hmm. it's not just throwing advertising out and hoping that it works. It can be highly measured, highly optimized, and deliver insane needle-moving results for businesses.
Yeah, and measured in more precise and way these days on a lot of different platforms, and making yeah. sure your best practices and monies are invested in the right way, and then you can track it, and then if not, adjust accordingly for sure.
Yeah, we do that on steroids, basically.
Okay.
So we have a client that has close to 150 individual locations around the U.S., and we can dial up and dial down advertising based on those markets and the capacity that client has within that market, so that we're actually not spending money in a direction that is just sort of getting, when you're focused on essentially direct conversions and making sure that you can fill capacity in your business, we can do it on a hypermarket level. We're doing crazy things where we're mapping back in first party data like phone calls, so that we can actually show that someone saw an ad on a website. They may have never clicked on it,
but viewed it.
They viewed it.
Yeah.
And so we are able to say that they saw it and they later made a phone call about it and converted. So,
yeah.
So it's that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's real information that people want these days. You know, we hear all the time from different marketing agencies and people involved in that space that people are always looking when it comes to their smartphone or their internet, but they're not always engaging. And when you get them to engage, that's a whole nother conversation. But if you can just get them to look, but how do you measure how many people are just window shopping per se? So so you're able to do a lot of that. Michael,
and
you got
Kit, does this apply to like email campaigns as well? This kind of tracking and data-driven analysis.
And in fact, email is this, I feel like this, I don't want to say redheaded stepchild, because I feel like that's becoming a derogatory term at this point in history, but email is a very underserved. Mm-hmm. So we acquired a company about 3 weeks ago, is an amazing specialist in the strategy and execution of mm-hmm. email-based campaigns. We also have been hired by a company that is one of the largest independent email and marketing automation mm-hmm. service providers that's out there, in order to help them with strategy and growth in new markets. So I think what we're seeing is that it's not just batch and blast, as we call it in the industry, right. for email, but it's actually truly looking at email being highly effective for the people that it's being sent to. So making sure that we're subject line testing, that we're delivering segmented content over email. And even some services will have different data pulled into an email based on when you actually open it up. So mm-hmm. it can be a highly sophisticated science versus mm-hmm. just the batch and blast. Mm-hmm. Like, here's an email that I'm going to send to 10,000 people.
Right, right. At the beginning of this program, I was sharing with you that we, Block Specialty Finance, launched Capital Club Radio in a partnership with Atlanta Business yeah. Radio. And we have these podcasts that we send out. And so I'm very interested to see if we can measure the impact and the effectiveness of those podcasts that we send out probably every other week, mm-hmm. because I think it's catching on, but I want to make sure that our investment in this media, you know, right. makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's got the potential that I hope it does.
You have to treat email like it's a channel, just like anything else, like paid search would be, or display advertising, or okay. LinkedIn advertising, or social. Email is not this little lever over in the corner that gets pulled. It should be considered as a peer with all these other channels.
Okay. And it's often not. It's overlooked.
Oh,
it's not used to its fullest advantage. And certainly it's abused on many cases yeah. as well.
Yeah, there's a reason why Congress had to put in there's essentially when Congress moves to limit and regulate a specific advertising channel, it's a very big sign that it's yeah. likely been abused.
That's right. So let's talk about the horizon for advertising. You're already saying you're dialing it into someone's backyard based on what they yeah. want. And we hear that, my house may be not getting the same ads in the future that my neighbor's house will be getting based on who lives there and the type of products we consume and the Internet of Things. Talk to yeah. us about that.
Oh, man, that's the sweet spot. So, and the Internet of Things is very interesting because there's a whole new data set that's going to be at advertisers' disposal, if you will, when it comes to Internet of Things. So it may be that right now some advertising is being targeted at you based on websites that you've been to. Mm-hmm. So you went to go see a website and then you notice you're seeing display ads over and over again because you went to that website. Well, the next step is that sophisticated advertisers are mapping in some of their own sort of first-party data, or they're looking at weather patterns, or they're looking at purchase data that they can essentially say, hey, if this person made these purchases, they're maybe more likely to be receptive to advertising based mm-hmm. on my products or services. So when you look at how Internet of Things, and this will tie into the route your car drives to and from home, what's in your refrigerator, what are you cooking on your stove? What's your average home temperature? All of these things that are likely talking to each other to feed off of each other
right.
and make decisions.
To create a profile of you, the consumer yeah. or the person.
Which I want to go on the record and say, this is not a bad thing.
Okay.
And there is a very strong generational divide in which the term Big Brother is just being worked out of the lexicon. And it doesn't mean that security goes away, but it does mean that we should not fear that this data that is helping to make more fine-tuned advertising to us available. So there's a rise of ad blockers right now, which is annoying to ad agencies, but we'll figure a way around it. The intent for us as agencies is to figure out the way to serve the most relevant advertising to people. And if we have more data, which is abstracted in a lot of cases, so we don't know your name or your phone number, it's very, very abstracted, we can serve up very relevant advertising. So the ads that you hate go away. The brands that aren't relevant for you go away. The brands that you love, that's the advertising you see. The products that are very relevant to you that you may be buying, those are the ones that you see. So with Internet of Things, there's a whole new data set that's going to be available. It's going to change advertising in the next decade.
It certainly is. It's progressing to horizons that we do not know where it will lead us. But
that's a great way to say it.
Yeah, we do. You just got to embrace it because it's not going anywhere, right? Technology is here to stay and only progressing. And as the younger generation gets involved, you know, we had someone in here last week talking about Gen Z.
Yeah.
Like, what happened to, you know, the millennials? We're already past millennials. We're talking about Gen Z now. I mean, come on. So, and they don't even like email, by the way.
Yeah.
They only want to communicate via text message or Snapchat.
Yeah, you know,
email is as outdated to them. So
yeah,
if you're trying to reach them, for sure. So, but glad we have a guy like you on the case out there, understanding all this, you know, spearheading these digital technology and digital advertising avenues, for sure. If listeners want to find out more information about your services, how would they do so?
Just go to looklisten.com.
Looklisten.com.
It is as straightforward as that.
Looklisten.com. So very good. Well, before we get out, just a few other questions for both of our guests here today. We'll talk about entrepreneurialism and talk about Atlanta for sure. And for you, Kit, first, I'd like to know, is it a good idea or a bad idea to hire family members?
Bad idea.
Okay. Hey, we've heard both sides of the coin here in this studio, but from your perspective, not a good idea.
Let me tell you why.
Okay.
You can't fire family, and you shouldn't run your company like it's a family. We in our hyper growth, so we're getting close to 50 full-time employees. We've made the rise from two, me and my co-founder, to 50 within a really short period of time. We're talking like 3-4 years. Some of the things as we were hiring people very quickly was that we wanted to make sure that they understood that we had a set of values. One of those things was, this is not a family. It's a team. Mm-hmm. You can't fire family. You can't trade family.
Mm-hmm.
A team is very, very different. There's a different sort of focus and goal. Now, I love my family.
Certainly.
But I do not think that hiring family members is right. And take that in the context of the fact that I run an ad agency, an industry that's known for employing unemployable personalities. we give home to highly creative people,
right?
And in a way that is no other company could give them that home,
right?
And so bringing family into that mix doesn't work for our industry,
right? Well, Michael, your thoughts? Is good idea, bad idea?
I agree with Kit. Absolutely not.
No family on the staff.
I mean, an internship or something, that's one thing, but and I've done that with one of my daughters,
right?
But that's different. No way.
Right.
No way, because you have to hold people accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And at Flock Finance, we are very, very focused on results.
And it sends a different message to the office if you have a family member working there and they walk into your office and say, Daddy, what are we doing for lunch today?
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute, I can't do
There's
this.
There's no
right?
way.
Right.
There's no way.
Right. Well, that's a good one for sure. We'll mark that down here for these guys here. Now, a good idea, bad idea, Kit, to allow, you know, everybody's talking about culture these days, creating a culture, an office space, to allow dogs in the office.
So we were highly profiled when Atlanta Business Chronicle ran a piece on dogs in the workplace. I think we had the most photos, or we were tied with another Atlanta company with the photos. So we are also not in Class A office space in a high rise. so we're in a converted warehouse, like you would think that some hip ad agency is these days. But so we allow them, we encourage them. We did have to write a policy that said, hey, your dog may be asked to leave if it is considered aggressive. So we'll give everybody a chance. But also we ask our people to coordinate with our operations manager so that we don't have a pack of six dogs running around.
Right.
But we have found that when clients come to visit, they love to see the dogs. And but we are also like 75% of our office space is concrete floors as well.
So it makes it okay. But you know, that's something they say. They have dogs in the office. I want to do business with them. They've got a great culture. And I'm a huge dog lover myself. And this place I used to work at allowed us to bring our dogs to the office. My dog got fat over there at the office. She learned to go to every office and get treats from everyone.
Yeah.
Eventually had to hang a sign on her that says, please do not feed me. And then eventually stopped working there. But you know, that's, some people say that that creates a better work environment, not only for the employees, but perhaps people visiting the office.
Absolutely.
Any dogs at the office at Flock Specialty Finance?
No, thank you. I think it's different, though. I mean, if you were finance, an ad agency.
Right. Finance guys.
In a warehouse, that's very, very different. In our world, I'm not even sure at the Galleria if they would allow pets, but I could see problems because, you know, somebody may want to bring their cats in the office. Well, I'm allergic to cats.
Yeah. You know, I don't like cats. Cats are evil. So, so no cats.
Okay. Right. But also we have investors that visit frequently, and I'm not sure, frankly, that's the brand that we want. That
you're absolutely
different,
right.
If it's a different, business.
Right. They're coming in there in their fancy Italian suits. You don't want them, you know, Pucci jumping up on top of them.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
That's true. So, well, let's talk about Atlanta for a moment. So, Atlanta's been your home for a number of years, Michael.
Well, right? It's my home since 2000. It's my wife's home since she was born.
Right.
So,
but it's now your home.
Excuse me. We lived though for 8 years in New Jersey.
But it is home for business now. And what do you think about Atlanta?
No, I love Atlanta. I didn't really want to come here, but my wife was so miserable up in New Jersey. She hated it so much. She didn't want New Jersey on the birth certificate of our kids. So I had to drive from Morristown, New Jersey to the east side of Manhattan in the middle of the night. So my daughter could have a New York birth certificate.
You're kidding.
My wife hated New Jersey so much. So sorry, Chris Christie.
But
anyway, so we moved back. We were married here way back when, but we only lived here for a year. And then I joined Dun & Bradstreet. But I have become very much Atlanta. I joined the board of the History Center.
Okay.
I'm on the board of trustees there. I raised a lot of money, contributed a lot of money also to the Atlanta History Center, which is now almost becoming like a cultural center. And what Sheffield Hale has done for that is astounding.
Wow.
I mean, it is no longer just a museum. It is a cultural center.
And they've moved the cyclorama over there, right?
The cyclorama's coming over there. We've expanded it. We've got, you know, lots of book lectures, all kinds of things. Super Jenny's even doing a joint venture with it now.
Fun.
So I've been on the board in there for 4 years and really, really feel that it's going to be even more important than it is today.
Yeah.
Then I also just joined the board of the Shakespeare Company, the Shakespeare Tavern.
Oh, nice.
Both my daughters had performed there.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I'm very much into that.
So it's a great way for you to give back to the community that's helped you grow and start your business.
Exactly.
And then what do you like to do in your off time? What do you really like to do to get away from it all?
Well, I love to play golf.
Okay.
You know, so as you get older, you know, golf is a sport that you can do till you're pretty old. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get serious about it until about 5 or 6 years ago, started taking lessons. And so I absolutely love golf. I feel very inspired when I'm out on the course. Occasionally I duff a ball, and, you know, but.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Well, there you heard it here first, folks. You can find Michael Flock out on the golf course or down at the Shakespeare Tavern or the Atlanta History Center giving back or behind his fancy desk over there at Flock Specialty Finance for sure.
With no dogs.
Yeah, that's okay. No that's a, there's a place for him everywhere. And what about you, Kit? What do you like to do in your off time? I know you said you had three kids, right?
Three kids keep me really, really busy. Yeah. So, and you know, I didn't choose Atlanta. Atlanta chose me. Really, when I think about it, moved here in the fall of 2000 with trying to get that first company in a stronger market, and it just it was like there was an interesting energy to Atlanta itself, and I found that this city, amazing, fantastic airport. We worked with the streetcar, which is a fantastic addition to the city, even though it's getting a lot of criticism and people don't totally know it. It's going to be something that the next generation of Atlantans thank us for. Our agency wants to be the great ad agency that came out of Atlanta, not the one that opened an office in Atlanta. Mm. And so this city has been fantastic for our growth. Love the diversity. Absolutely love the diversity. And in my off time, I've got three. When is there off time?
Yeah, never.
Yeah, come on.
Running a successful business. Right?
I try to not work on the weekends and hang out with my family, wife and kids. And my wife is from Atlanta, grew up in Decatur and then out in Gwinnett. So so she knows this city very, very well. And we spend a lot of time outdoors playing. Yeah, I mean, three kids. We got three. It's crazy. It's
crazy. Sounds like a lot going on for sure. And in other ways, you'd like to give back. You mentioned you're partnering with the streetcar and are wanting to work with them and expand their brand. But any other ways that your company or you personally, nonprofit groups or ways you like to give back?
Yeah, so it's a really hard one to answer because up until having three kids, I was highly involved in trying to figure out how technology can be used to make life better. Because that's my personal...
For everyone.
For everyone. My personal vision in this world is that technology can be used to make people's life better, whether that's in a project that I helped out with in rural Kenya or, you know, the list could go on and on. But once I had three kids, it was extremely hard to have anything else. So I'm highly focused on being a great father and raising, which my wife does a fantastic job. She's full-time dedicated to these kids, and her job is much harder than mine is running a hyper-growth company. But I feel like the best thing that I can do for this world is to raise three amazing human beings. I have the two of them are girls, one boy, and I am working on helping my son along with my two daughters to teach him what it's like to be a man in this day and age, and using my daughters and sort of the values that we're setting to help him learn that, because I think that we're at this sort of nice point in history at which a man doesn't have to use force and doesn't have to do all these things that are traditional masculinity. And I think I think women should run the world, and I'm using my daughters to help them learn those lessons. And then the only other thing is that I chose 6 years ago to be vegetarian.
Okay.
After being a strong, lifelong meat eater, growing up in the South.
And, how's that working out for you?
It's been fantastic.
Nice.
And so
health reasons or moral reasons?
It started out as health, and then very quickly became moral reasons. And then I've done some sort of vegan stints throughout the 6 year period, but most recently have been over the this year, the beginning of the year, have dedicated myself completely to a vegan diet. And so the city could use some more vegan restaurants.
Well,
That's one huge thing, because the person can by making some decisions on taking animal products off of their plate, they can make the impact as simple as, like, basically the global impact of an SUV on a yearly basis is what they can kind of remove out of their carbon footprint by choosing to not eat animal products. It's absolutely amazing.
So. Well, that sounds fantastic. I'd love to explore that with you. Maybe have you back and do a whole show about that. And go
Happy
into more details
it.
About how people can adopt that lifestyle, because it is something that, again, it's a personal mission that more and more people are resonating with these days.
So, absolutely. And it's so easy to do. It's so much easier to do than people think. And I'm living proof of that.
How about that? All right. Well, thank you, Kit Hughes, CEO, founder, Look, Listen, for joining us here on Atlanta Business Radio. Thank you, Michael Flock, founder of Flock Specialty Finance. You guys are great. Two of Atlanta's best and brightest out there doing good work. Thank you for joining us here today on Atlanta Business Radio. And we are Business Radio X, amplifying the voice of business. So if your company is out there doing something interesting to generally serve your market, your profession, reach out to us directly on the contact page at businessradiox.com and pitch us your story. Thank you to Stone Payton and Lee Cantor. And on behalf of the entire Business Radio X network, I'm Ryan Redhawk McPherson. We will see you on the radio.